I'm going to try to walk you through the case pretty quickly, and Mike is going to comment a bit, and we hope to leave ample time for questions. So this was a pro se case all the way up until it got to the Supreme Court. The prisoner filed it himself. He, as Sarah said, he's made some mistakes. Don't believe everything about him you read in the press. Arkansas has considerably exaggerated what he's done over the years and what he's been in for, but he has made some serious mistakes. He filed this lawsuit pro se. The district judge said you got to have a, told the magistrate, who's a sort of assistant judge, to have a preliminary injunction hearing. Prisoner appeared, represented himself, testified, cross-examined the warden, scored some points on cross-exam. They said, if he escapes, he could shave his beard and change his appearance. And Holt says, well, why don't you take one picture with the beard and one picture without the beard? And you'd think they might have thought of that question, but they obviously hadn't, and they gave totally non-responsive answers. And there were some other examples. We got a couple of gifts in this case. One was the magistrate said, he just heard the testimony, he has the prisoner in front of him, he's looking at the beard, he says, it's almost preposterous to think you could hide anything in that beard. But there's a larger principle here, which is I have to defer to these people. And then he filed written findings that essentially accepted everything the prison authorities had said. So that idea of deference, where does that come from? Well, this is not a constitutional case, it's a statutory case. The statute is called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which is a bit of an odd combination, but Congress tried to pass a broader bill that would apply to the states and would be kind of a general religious liberty bill, and they discovered they were too divided to do it. But the two areas that emerged from a series of hearings were land use regulation in churches and denying religious liberty rights to prisoners. So they passed a bill that's just about those two things, and the statutory standard in the text of the statute is compelling interest in least restrictive means. If the prison authorities substantially burden a prisoner's exercise of religion, they have to show that burden is the least restrictive means to further a compelling interest. But then the legislative history says, compelling interest depends on context, and we anticipate that courts will give due deference to the experience and expertise of prison administrators. How much deference is due? Well, they didn't say. And the judicial reaction to that invitation, as you might expect, has been mixed. So some judges have taken the statute seriously. They've said the standard's compelling interest, least restrictive means. Due deference if they make a good case. Judge Gorsuch in the Tenth Circuit recently said deference can push a close case over the line. And other judges, including the Eighth Circuit where Arkansas is, have pretty much said deference means absolute deference. It means whatever they say goes. And actually, if you trace through the Eighth Circuit cases, it's quite clear they are not applying a statutory standard at all. They're applying the constitutional standard that the statute was designed to replace. They put the burden of proof on the prisoner, which is what the old constitutional rule did, when the statute explicitly puts the burden of proof on the prison officials. Arkansas didn't prove much, but they got a win in the district court. But the trial judge, not the magistrate, but the district judge, while dismissing the case, also left in place a preliminary injunction that allowed him to have a half-inch beard. Why a half-inch? Well, Muhammad said, leave the beard uncut, and that's really the teaching. Prisoner found a case from California that allowed a half-inch beard, and so he said, I'm willing to compromise. I'll settle for half an inch. And they said, no, you can't even have a half an inch because you could hide things in it and you could change your appearance by shaving it off. And besides, how do we know how long an inch is? How can we administer a half-inch limit? And finally, they said, you can't make exceptions in prisons. The prisoner who gets an exception will either be resented and become a target for violence, or he'll become a leader. But either way, you can't make exceptions in prison. Well, that says we can never apply the statute, because what the statute does is require religious exceptions in prisons. The other problem they had was they allow quarter-inch beards for medical reasons. And yeah, it's obviously shorter than half an inch, but it at least has the same problem of making exceptions and of having a length limit that has to be administered. So the trial judge dismisses the case but leaves in place a preliminary injunction that lets him have a half-inch beard. The Eighth Circuit affirms in a short, unpublished order. He files a handwritten cert petition and a handwritten motion for an injunction from the Supreme Court pending disposition of the cert petition. And he gets it. He gets the injunction pending disposition of the cert petition. Doesn't happen very often. They don't pull these handwritten petitions out very often. I think what might have happened, Alito was a circuit justice. And Alito, when he was on the Third Circuit, wrote an opinion about police officers in Newark where they allowed religious beards, but allowed medical beards, but not religious beards. And so this looked kind of like a case he had decided. maybe that's why he pulled it out. But in any event, he pulls it out, refers it to the court. He gets the preliminary injunction from the Supreme Court. That preliminary injunction shows up on the order list, and that was the first time anyone in the religious liberty community knew about this case. So I went down to Arkansas to interview him, and eventually he got referred to me. I filed a supplemental brief and then a reply brief on the cert petition, and cert was granted. So I brought the briefs for show and tell. Everything is color-coded. Blue for petitioner, red for respondent, yellow is the reply brief, gray is always the United States, and then the amicus briefs. Light green supporting us, one dark green supporting them. Alabama filed a brief for 18 states, which means 32 states refused to sign it. The briefing was pretty lopsided in this case. And you know, the problem for Arkansas was they really didn't have a record of any danger, and we kept pushing on, you know, there are no examples of anything here. And they said, well, we get to make prophylactic rules. We can prevent the harm before it happens. We don't have to wait until somebody gets hurt before we can make a rule about it. And they said, you know, Six, which is a religious group from India, one of their five principal obligations is to carry a ceremonial dagger with them at all times. I said, you know, do we have to allow daggers in the prison until something bad happens so we have an example? And I finally figured out to say, you know, look, if it's so obvious that no prison would ever allow it, then you're not going to have examples. But here, 43 prison systems allow beards. 40 allow beards without a length limit. If they were causing problems, you would have plenty of examples, and you have no examples. Arkansas allowed beards without a length limit until 1998, and the two witnesses who testified for the state had a combined 40-some years experience in the Arkansas prison system before the rule was changed. You know, they didn't seem to remember any examples. So they didn't have any examples. They didn't have any explanation of why, didn't have a good explanation of why they couldn't do what these other 40 states did. you know, they said, well, I didn't say this to court. I thought of this as the argument, we run our prison system so badly that we can't permit things that other states permit. So their big thing was, we allow maximum security prisoners to work outside the wall. We have this massive agricultural operation. Lots of states have that, but only for minimum security prisoners, and not on Arkansas scale. So they're kind of running it like a plantation, these maximum security guys outside, and so that increases the risk. Well, maybe it increases the risk. It doesn't make a half-inch beard a better hiding place. And that argument kept evolving over time. We got a completely new version of an oral argument that they had never mentioned before. I don't think the court's going to go that way, right? You don't get to make a new factual argument for the first time on oral argument. So the argument went about as well as I think we could have hoped. The way I prepare for an oral argument in the Supreme Court, and this is pretty common, I think, one, you try to anticipate all the likely questions, and you know you don't get very long to answer them before you're interrupted with the next question, so you try to prepare very short, to-the-point answers that gets the maximum impact out of one or two sentences. And then I always take with me a manila folder, no papers inside it, just open up the middle folder, and you got two sides to write on, and a list of points just in case I actually get a minute to say something on my own initiative, and just in case my mind's gone blank at that moment, and glance down and pick up one of those points. Never, ever do you get to make one of those points, because it's all questions all the time. On Tuesday, I not only got to make some of those points, I ran out of the list. I had to make some points I hadn't written down. Who would have thunk it? But the questions were not as unbalanced as it kind of felt like, or as that account makes it seem. There were, somebody did this count because there's research that shows the side that gets the most questions usually loses. It's not 100%, but it's apparently a pretty strong correlation. So Arkansas guy got 52 questions, I got 23, but the United States took 10 minutes of my argument time, and they got, I think, 22. So, so 52 to 45, I guess, is not that unbalanced. But the government lawyer got as many questions as I did in half the amount of time. So I was feeling pretty relaxed up there. And then in rebuttal, it's hard to say much time for rebuttal because you can't extricate yourself from the questions. And then when you stand up to make your rebuttal, there's immediately a question. You don't get to say anything you would have said in a rebuttal because it's all questions all the time. I actually got to use a rebuttal. I don't think that's ever happened before either. So from our perspective, the argument went very well. The administrative interest we can't measure a half inch was pretty explicitly abandoned at the argument. The we can't make any exceptions ever was kind of abandoned in the brief. Conceded an awful lot on hiding contraband and really hung his hat on this new elaborated version of they can change their identity. And by the end, Justice Alito was sort of openly making fun of the state's position, right? Which is never a good sign if you're the lawyer it's happening to. So he says, why don't you give the guards a comb? And you can design it any way you want. And they can hand it to the prisoner and make him comb out his beard. And then a SIM card, that was one of the things that claimed to be hidden in a beard, is the key piece of electronics that makes a cell phone go. Yeah. If a SIM card is in there or a tiny revolver is in there, it'll fall out, right? I say, well, that's a good idea. That might work. And then the new argument at about changing appearance, initially it had been if you escape, you might change your appearance and it'll be harder for us to catch you. We said they didn't have any examples of that, so they did a Westlaw search in newspaper stories, and they found about 10 stories since Westlaw started covering newspapers in the last 30 years where prisoners had escaped and had shaved their beards, and most of them it didn't appear that shaving the beard had made any difference. One of them, we were breathlessly told he was eluding guards and bloodhounds. I'm sure the bloodhounds were fooled by the missing beard, but anyhow, they had those examples. Well, by oral argument, this had morphed into we have 30 to 60 prisoners together in an open room in a barracks. They don't have individual cells. We keep enemies apart by putting one in one barracks and one in the other barracks, and you know they could. When they come in from the fields, you know, they could switch uniforms and deal with another prisoner and shave their beard and fool the guard and get into the other barracks and assault their enemy. And Alito basically says, let me get this. He's going to go out in the fields, and he's somehow going to shave his beard off while he's out there. He's going to find another prisoner who looks like him, and they're going to trade IDs and uniforms and come back in. And the whole tone of this was just extraordinary skepticism. I don't know how the others felt. Arkansas stuck to their guns, and he said, well, they'll probably shave in the morning before they go out there. And yeah, this does happen, and beards will make it worse. The underlying question in the case, Chief Justice Roberts thought a half-inch beard was too easy, and we should have been asking for a full beard. The harder question, the more important question in the case is, how do you administer deference in the context of a statutory standard that says compelling interest, least restrictive means? That sounds like a contradiction in terms, right? And it's hard to, in some ways, this was a political compromise. it was hard to come up with a short, pithy test. But what we basically said was, prisons have to take the statute seriously. They have to consider solutions that are found in other states. If it's a, if something's been tried and there ought to be examples of it not working, they ought to have to offer those examples. But the more seriously they take the question, the more serious their consideration, the more careful their explanation, the more deference will be due. We'll see what the Supreme Court says. But that was our proposal. And Arkansas's proposal was basically, unless it's unless their explanation is totally ridiculous, to defer to it. And since one of their explanations here had already been found to be totally preposterous, that I'm not sure helped them very much. So that's kind of how the argument went. I'll leave the remaining time for questions, and Professor Schwartzman is going to make a few comments as well.
I just wanted to make two points, partly just to zoom out from the oral argument in Holt v. Hobbs, which Professor Laycock has so nicely described for you. The first point is to say that this particular case wasn't on the radar for litigators in this area until Justice Alito intervened in it. But the type of case that it is was something that was recognized in advance. And in fact, the University of Virginia Supreme Court Litigation Clinic has was involved in a case similar to this one in 2010. A case called Iron Thunder Horse against Pierce, which nearly went the distance. The Supreme Court called for the views of the Solicitor General in that case. It involved a similar claim about hair length filed by a Native American out of the Fifth Circuit. That case was ultimately denied, but not before extensive briefing on the issue. So this isn't the first time the Supreme Court has seen in our loop a case involving a prisoner making a claim for a religious accommodation about hair length of one kind or another. Iron Thunder Horse came to the clinic because of some work by students who were focused on religious accommodations, especially notes written by James Nelson for the Virginia Law Review, a note called Incarceration, Accommodation, and Strict Scrutiny, and another note by a student named Taylor Stout, involving the costs of religious accommodations in prisons. And those notes are cited in some of these amicus briefs. They're discussed there. So there had been some legwork, sort of as preliminary to some of this litigation. Now, I don't know if that was, if that had any bearing on this particular litigation, if Justice Alito or some of the other members of the court had seen some of this. It's possible, I mean, given that they called for the views of the Solicitor General on the earlier case, it's possible anyway that that Iron Thunder Horse or other cases served as some kind of predecessor, at least to flag the issue that there was a conflict among the circuits, which was already quite clear in 2010, but that had been deepened in the years leading up to Holt v. Hobbs. So anyway, there's some background to this case. UVA has been involved in thinking about this, I think, in one fashion or another for a while, and it's great to see come to fruition at oral argument this week. The other thing I would say, and this is, again, by way of sort of zooming out from this particular argument, but thinking about free exercise litigation more generally, after the court's decision in Hobby Lobby, there were sharp contrasts between, you could say, progressives and conservatives, or I don't know how exactly you want to describe it, opposing sides, and what seems to be a culture war over certain set of religious accommodations. But accusations were quite heated on both sides, and one of the arguments is that at least for a certain segment of the progressive left, that there is an abandonment of the value of religious free exercise or religious accommodation. And I think one of the nice things about Holt v. Hobbs is it suggests anyway that there still remains some important consensus on the value of religious accommodation, especially when the state hasn't come forward to suggest or make any evidentiary showing that there are harms to those who don't benefit from those accommodations. Under those circumstances, it does seem like there is still quite an important and powerful consensus that the state ought to ought to be concerned about religious accommodations and granting exemptions, and that when it burdens religion, it ought to have an important or compelling reason to do so. So I'll just make those two points. There's a prehistory to this case, and I think it's a good sign that Virginia has been involved in that, and I think that students have played an important role in helping us to understand the contours of the law. That should be some encouragement to those of you who are thinking about writing in these areas, that you can make a difference in practical litigation. And the second point is just the politics of Holt, I think, complicate the story that we're telling.